So to understand how modern hacking works, and what Ryan Green eventually did, you need to know a little bit about the dark side of the web. So there's an internet we're all familiar with, the one you get by typing a URL into the address line of your browser. It's what you type after www. And that's what's known as the open web. A level below that, there's something called the deep web. If you try to go to it, you'll be stopped. You need passwords or pay subscription fees to get into it. This is what they mean when they say it's behind a paywall. The New York Times digital edition, it lives in the deep web. But there's a third level, one you might not be familiar with. And that third level is called the dark web, and it's exclusive.
You have to maim a certain number of people to get to the next level. You have to show that you were the creator of an exploit, and it did this much damage. Now, all of a sudden, you've made your bones.
So you have to be worthy.
You have to be worthy and trustworthy.
And that's what Ryan Green was determined to be, worthy.
So after evaluating this, and I started to devise a way how I could work my way up the food chain to be at the top of this world my whole life. I want to be the best at everything.
For years, we've heard about how the dopamine in the adolescent brain contributes to their making rash decisions. Beta Mogadem's research suggests that the adolescent brain is hungry for dopamine.
So we do see lower dopamine in adolescent brain. That seems to be part of the quote-unquote normal development, that you have this period of low dopamine.
There are lots of experiments on this and disagreement about exactly how much dopamine is in the teenage brain. What researchers do agree on is that young people between the ages of 13 and 24 appear to process dopamine differently than adults. In Beta's lab, the rats had learned if they pushed a pedal in their cage or heard a beep or saw a light, a short time later, a sugar pellet would roll its way down to them. If adult rats hear that noise, they get a little shot of dopamine just imagining how tasty that pellet will be. But adolescent rats? Not so much. It appears they need to act, actually hit the pedal, before they get that dopamine rush. In other words, in adolescence, anticipation isn't enough. And Mogadem suspects that's why teenagers, or at least teenage rats, start seeking rewards and making decisions without that momentary pause that adults typically have.
You know, everybody makes bad decisions, and everybody does stupid things. Adolescents do more of it. If you're raised an adolescent, you know that. It happens.
But that shouldn't necessarily be seen as a negative thing.
I think we need to be conscious of the fact that all these behavioral traits were absolutely critical. So thrill-seeking, sensation-seeking, the willingness to go and explore danger, novel environments, those behavioral traits are actually quite important. And by understanding them, we're not necessarily understanding a bad thing that needs to be tamed.
So maybe, if it's seen in the right way, hacking doesn't need to be tamed necessarily. I mean, look how well it turned out for Michael Chamos. Maybe it just needs to be better directed. So there's something else that's interesting about those dopamine levels. They may be an evolutionary fix that helps the human species survive.
The simplest way of summarizing a lot of different really intricate research is this. Nature needs this adolescent to be driven to novelty for all sorts of reasons.
Daniel Siegel is an interpersonal neurobiologist at UCLA, and he wrote a best-selling book about the power and promise of the adolescent brain. He thinks the change in dopamine levels is nature's way of getting humans to develop.
Novelty, seeking something you're not familiar with, is what nature needs adolescents to do, and the best way to do that is to alter your dopamine system so you feel a little restless with the familiar. That's the bottom line of baseline of dopamine is lower. So when you do the novel thing, you go, whoa, that may have been scary and new, but boy, did that feel good.
And that's what led Ryan Green to create something that hadn't been created before. A place in the dark web where hackers could trade ideas and share secrets. A place where people who were just pretending to be great hackers would not be allowed.
You know, there's all these other hacking forums out there. Well, they were full of script kiddies.
Script kiddies. The ultimate hacker pejorative. A hacker who steals other people's code and can't write their own.
And were just annoying. And thought they were awesome and gave hackers a bad name.
Just because they were so unskilled?
Yeah, they would be unskilled, and then they would do stupid things.
So Ryan Green wanted to create a place where he wouldn't have to deal with script kiddies, a virtual clubhouse for the cool hackers. And they came up with a rather ingenious way to keep the script kiddies out. They required people to apply for membership. The price of admission? A real-world demonstration of an amazing hack. Show Ryan and the other members how you did it, they find it worthy, and you're in. Of course, this new cool hacker place needed a name, so they called it Dark Code.
Well, I can tell you that when we were growing up and we were figuring out how to hack, it was much more of the exchange of ideas and curiosity.
To someone like Katie Musarius, the problem is in an open society. Once you hack, the line between good and evil can quickly blur, especially for a teenager.
Feeding that curiosity, that can lead you to some dark places.
Katie, for her part, resisted the pull of the dark side and is now a white hat hacker. She counsels big companies like Microsoft on how to protect against the kind of people who do this.
The nature of hacking is that to secure a system, you have to understand its holes. So you can be doing the same exact hacking activity, and what you do with it after that, what you do with what you found out, is really what determines, you know, whether you've gone dark side or light side. But it's the exact same set of skills, and it's the exact same activity.
We're in this digital age where one of the central questions is, are we going to abandon our pre-digital norms?
David Hickton is the U.S. attorney who led a prosecution against the creators of Dark Code.
Well, for me, it's just fundamental that I would not try to take over someone else's phone. If someone else had a phone, I would consider it their property. I wouldn't eavesdrop on someone else's phone. I think one of the most fantastic dramas as we apply law to digital space is what are our notions of privacy. And it appears clear to me they're different for some people than they are for at least me. And we may not have norms today. So when you take these individuals who are relatively young in their 20s and they profess to have this hacking skill, I guess the question is, what is the boundaries of hacking, both legally and otherwise?
So it would help adolescent hackers to have some cyberspace guidelines, but very little of that exists right now. Staying out of black hat territory can be a judgment call.
So it's essentially breaking into stuff, and then do you tell somebody about it so they can fix it, or do you keep breaking in?
Here's an interesting fact. That kind of black hat hacking that we've been talking about, the kind of things that would help you get into Dark Code, it's virtually non-existent in Israel.
That's him. There he comes. It's him.
Isaac Ben Israel is considered the father of Israel's cyber program. Though if you ask him, he'll tell you he doesn't like that title very much.
I don't like names like this. I mean, cyber has two sides. One of them is the dark side. So I don't like names like this.
Ben Israel founded the first cyber unit in the Israeli Defense Forces in 1992, just a year after the Internet went public. And he's been thinking about hacking and why people do it ever since.
What is the hacker's mentality?
Israeli hackers are considered among the world's best, but few end up on the dark web. The reason for that is that Israel is trying to use culture and education to fight biology. They've developed a moral code for hackers. It's steering kids away from the dark side early, really early. For example, there are robotics classes in kindergarten, fourth grade coding classes, and a very selective after-school program called Magshimim, where essentially the government is trying to instill honor among budding cyber thieves, which, given the stakes, given how much hackers can do now, is more important than ever. Drive a couple hours north of Tel Aviv and you'll arrive in the agricultural town of Afula. It looks like Northern California in the 70s, all rolling hills and velvety fields as far as the eye can see. This is where the Magshimim program has an outpost.
I'm trying to change their state of mind that they are not simple students that just need to pass through some tests or some, educational stuff.
Michael Vayner is a Magshimim instructor.
They need to want it for themselves. I'm trying to inspire them. I'm trying to give them the motivation so they could start something by their own only because their will to start it.
So Mang Chi Meme sounds like one of those enrichment programs we have in the U.S. for super motivated teens. But what's different is the emphasis on the responsibility they now have to use what they're learning for something good, maybe even something noble.
Every session we do in Mang Chi Meme is accompanied by a very long lecture on morality and ethics and how we can use this knowledge to benefit society, to benefit ourselves, to not do any harm.
Do they use the word hacking?
Yeah, we guess that using it, I guess, to acquire certain knowledge from the internet to hack. Yes, that would be the wrong way.
Ryan saw hacking into some impenetrable system as a challenge. Mang Chi Meme kids are taught to see it as a mistake.
I'm Ido Tzur. I live in north of Israel. I study in Afula in Mang Chi Meme. This is my third year. I'm in 12th grade.
So he's almost done with the program. He's freckled, ginger-haired, and he told us he dressed up as Donald Trump for Purim.
I know partially from my father and partially from Mang Chi Meme, but it's not a place you want to be in if you want to be a good citizen and a respected engineer in the community of computer science. It's just not something you want to have on your resume.
Israel is trying to develop hackers with a conscience, hackers who get their dopamine rush by hacking for the nation. And what about Ryan? Could a Mang Chi Meme program that channels his skills into something positive have made a difference?
You know, it really might have, but the most computer thing they had at school was keyboard in class, which I couldn't stand because it was just, you know, a slap in the face.
I think that for young people who are coming into their own just physically, emotionally, and, you know, intellectually, I think that this huge rush of being able to affect real systems in the real world and have this power, it's a very delicate place to be.
Computer security consultant Katie Musarius.
And I think that without channels and options to have them use that power and that feeling that they get for good, you know, the addiction may just become overwhelming and they may just choose to do it over and over again. But without those positive outlets, I fear essentially what options we're leaving to people with that kind of creativity. They're definitely not necessarily going to fit into anyone's particular mold of what they should do with their lives or what path they should take. So providing them flexible options and essentially letting them flex that power that they have found, that they have discovered, and grow that power, very, very important to not just the well-being and the psyche of these individuals, but really of our ability to defend ourselves in the internet age.
But even with all the progress Israel has made, it hasn't quite resolved all the moral questions that swirl around hacking. There's this guy named Gilad, and he worked for one of the technology units in the Israeli Defense Forces, a rather infamous unit called 8200. That's why we're only using his first name.
I'm Gilad.
No one is allowed to talk about what 8200 does exactly. That would be like revealing state secrets. But what we can say is that it does what you'd expect a spy unit to do. Surveillance, breaking into enemy systems, trolling for actionable intelligence.
You don't always understand the implications of what you're doing. You're just a small part. And you think you're part of something good, but you never know because you cannot know.
Part of Gilad's job in 8200 was to spy on Arabs and Palestinians. Some of his targets were known terrorists, but others seemed more like innocent bystanders. And it began to dawn on Gilad that while he had listened to these people as part of his job, he'd never actually sat down and talked with them one-on-one. So he began to seek these people out.
You go to school, you go to the army, frameworks, you meet Arabs your age and have real, you know, real-life talks, like just person-to-person conversations. The only way to know Arabs is through TV, and then you get like this kind of not-so-accurate kind of
stereotype.
Yes, exactly, stereotype.
And the more Arabs he met, the more visits he made to the occupied territories after his military service, the more he began to question what he had done while in Unit 8200, or more specifically, the morality of hacking for the nation.
something that bothered me. I said, like, okay, I'm pretty sure that we're the good guys and we're doing everything right, you know, and I did what I had to do, but I just want to make sure I want to talk with Arabs and hear their side of the story.
Gilad ended up taking his crisis of conscience public. He became one of 43 members of Unit 8200 to write an open letter questioning whether Israel had gone too far and was now invading the privacy of innocent Palestinians. The Refusnik letter, as it came to be known, rocked Israel.
We must take responsibility for our part in this situation. Therefore, those among us who are reservists refuse to take part in the state's actions against Palestinians. We call for the first reactions of officials like the Minister of Defense and the Prime Minister and other people, officials from the army, was they should be treated like criminals. They broke the law.
But they hadn't broken the law. They were careful not to reveal state secrets or to call on anyone else in Unit 8200 to follow their lead. In fact, in many ways, Gilad and the Refuseniks may have been the ultimate embodiment of what Israel claimed to want in its cyber force. Gilad was someone who not only had amazing computer skills, he had developed a moral code. The Refusnik letter focused attention on the biggest problem with hacking today. No one is quite sure where the limits are.
When you're there and it's your everyday work, you're not stopping to think about its moral implications or anything like that. And you feel like it has no repercussions. But yeah, it took us a while, a long while, years to understand that it does have repercussions.
Gilad is no longer serving as a reservist for Unit 8200. Today he works in the tech industry in Tel Aviv. Which brings us back to Ryan Green.
Was there a moment where you went, wait a minute, this thing has gone too far?
Yes. Yes, there's a moment like that.
And what was
definitely.
It?
Definitely. It was when the people that I started working with started moving towards doing fraudulent things with identities and credit cards.
Ryan and two other guys had built a network of private computers, something called a botnet. Think of a botnet as a bunch of computers that someone is controlling remotely, without you knowing it. Typically, if your computer is part of a botnet, it is carrying viruses and malware. But if you were part of Ryan's botnet, it was different. He had standards and rules, and he wouldn't let anyone use his botnet to spread malware. In fact, he took malware off the computers he was controlling in his botnet.
I was so self-conscious of all that, and we optimized it to actually search every computer that it installed on and clean any known virus that we could ever know or bought off of their computer and do updates, window updates, and secure that computer from being infected in the future from anybody else.
So you saw it as almost a customer service.
Yeah, almost. After a computer that was infected with our bot was infected, there's a good chance it probably was in better shape than it was when it got infected, which is kind of ironic.
Yes.
Just to be clear, Ryan wasn't being altogether altruistic. He was trying to keep their botnet healthy. If a computer on the bot was infected with a virus, it was much more likely its owner would reformat it, or take it to the shop, and then it wouldn't be part of the botnet anymore. So Ryan figured the least he could do is keep the computers in his network running in tip-top shape. To give you an idea of numbers, at its height, Ryan was controlling about 77,000 computers worldwide, and their owners didn't know. Then the rules changed.
Fastman kind of got greedy.
Fastman was the handle of one of his partners, and he wanted to make more money.
We kind of had like an internal little falling apart about all of it. And it ultimately led to me leaving and doing my own thing and them going down the path of Lord knows where.
Dark Code stopped being the special place where creative hackers could test and exchange ideas. And when it became about money, Ryan Green lost interest. He left Dark Code and started writing legitimate software programs to help companies follow up on internet sales leads. He'd been doing that for 3 years when he got an unexpected phone call.
The county attorney in Livingston County calls me and he says that he needs me to come down there and sign some paperwork. So we've got a brand new, big, nice courthouse. There's nobody in it ever. And I walk in And I think it's the first time I've ever even been in it, truth be told. And all of a sudden, people surround me on both ends of the hallway. And they pull out badges. They were basically like, you know why we're here.
Actually, he genuinely didn't know. But the more Ryan talked to the county attorney, the more it began to dawn on him that all this was about dark code.
Just wanted to, like, cry, you know? I did everything so carefully then to make sure that I was never caught, never on really anybody's radar to want to be caught. I obviously knew hacking and getting access to people's computer wasn't right, but I also felt like it wasn't like a major thing that I was doing. It was just like, oh, nonchalant. Everybody's doing it.
Ryan and three FBI agents sat in the courthouse and talked for hours. And Ryan laid it all out for them, how dark code had started, how it grew, who else was involved, and how it had changed.
And the local sheriff, shock. He's got this blank look on his face, and he just keeps saying, I had no idea that you could do things like this. And he said, if I would have known this, I'd put you to work of doing our cyber, Facebook investigations and things like that.
David Hickton has left the U.S. Attorney's Office and is now the founding director of a think tank, the University of Pittsburgh Institute for Cyber Law, Policy, and Security.
When you talk about the participants in Dark Code, there was no question, as far as I was concerned as U.S. attorney, that they were violating the law. And I had not one ounce of hesitation when I brought the indictment.
Ryan was sentenced in September of 2016. The charges focused on that botnet, those 77,000 computers he controlled.
Do you have a felony record?
I do now, yes.
Do you feel, like, regretful in some way and not regretful in another?
I do. It's tough. But also at the same time, I didn't get jail time. I did just get probation. You know, I was an avid hunter, so I lost my firearms. I can't vote. I was a very political person. I think the worst part is I do raise my daughter pretty much by myself and have been there with her always, and she has now started kindergarten, and I cannot volunteer at the school to help out, you know, be a watchdog dad and do that kind of thing because they don't allow felons in the school system. Who would have thought that I was make national news as a computer hacker, you know? I wouldn't say I'm proud of it, but I wouldn't say I'm 100% ashamed of it either.
In our next episode, we all know yawning's contagious, and so is laughter. But could suicide be as well?
If I was thinking about my future, and I'd be like, I don't really feel like I have a future.
That's next time on What Were You Thinking? This episode of What Were You Thinking was reported by me, Dina Temple Raston, and produced by Caitlin Pierce and Anna Adlerstein. Our editor is Martha Little, sound design and mixing by Version Control, and fact-checking by Darren Ankrum. I'm the executive producer with Martha Little. This is Audible.
This episode contains emotional content that may not be appropriate for all audiences.
So our story today starts with a young woman from Colorado named Riley Winters.
Mom, you are slim, thick, with a cute butt.
We're getting to know her through short, disjointed bursts on her Instagram account.
I mean, I love her laugh.
This is an actual picture this time. JK!
We're sitting on a sectional with Riley's mom, Lucretia Schwartzma, and we're all huddled around a laptop computer. There are pictures of Riley everywhere. On one wall, a close-up of her face. big brown eyes, perfect teeth. On another, there's Riley in a hat, Riley playing dress-up. They suggest that Riley's going to show up any minute and apologize for being late. Riley seems so happy in everything that we're watching.
Riley, she's beautiful. She was loving. She was funny. She was smart. She was a jokester, a prankster. She was a typical kid.
But Riley Winters killed herself in May of 2016. She was 15 years old.
Their school resource officer had just been there for, what did he say, only about a month?
Riley's stepdad is Joel Schwartzma.
He said, I'm new, and I don't know many people, many of the kids yet, but I knew Riley. Every day she came in and said hi to me and came up and had something to say. And he said, well, he was the one who let us know. And when he came in, his face was just, yeah. It was really hard on him, I think, too. So, and that was the start of a number of kids then that he had to go through that with, so.
Literally dozens of kids in and around Colorado Springs have killed themselves in the past couple of years. So many that it's hard to remember who died when.
Did Danny happen before Mackenzie?
After Mackenzie and after Kai and Riley, Henry was shot.
And parents are worried.
When this all happened, we didn't know what to do. The school didn't know what to do. The children didn't know what to do. It's like, this is a new thing. How do we deal with this?
I'm Dina Temple Raston, and this is What Were You Thinking? A show about kids' decisions, their developing brains, and what we might be able to do to help them make better choices. In this episode, we look at teen suicide, which has replaced homicide as the second leading cause of death among teenagers in the United States. Copycat suicides, like what's going on in Colorado Springs, are something they call suicide contagion, or suicide clusters. They're considered the most preventable teen suicides because they often aren't driven by mental health. Instead, they grow out of the way young people assess things, something that we have the power to change. We'll explain on this episode of What Were You Thinking? Before arriving in Colorado Springs, I wasn't convinced suicide contagion actually existed. As it turns out, suicide clusters are a real thing. The CDC defines it as an abnormal number of suicides that happen in succession within close proximity to each other. We saw them in Palo Alto, California in 2009 and 2014, and in Fairfax County, Virginia, just outside of Washington, a couple of years ago. Colorado Springs has been in the midst of one of those for the past 3 years.
In 2015, we had quite a few. We had gone from 6 the year before to 14. For 2016, the total is 15.
And Dr. Leon Kelly, the local medical examiner, said that so far this year,
it's actually increased fairly dramatically. As to date, we have 11 teen suicides, and we had those by beginning of May. Do some pretty easy math and count what that looks like over the course of the year, and you're talking about over 30. It's clearly not the direction that any of us want to be moving in.
Going into this, I had assumed that this was about troubled kids or mental illness or high school outcasts, but I was wrong about that, too.
They're not the problem kids. They're popular. They have all of these things going on for them.
Susan Whelan is one of the people tracking the suicides in Colorado and is trying to prevent more of them from happening. You've probably heard that old adage about lemmings and mass suicide. It was one of the unsolved mysteries of the animal kingdom. It turns out that that story isn't much of a mystery at all. In fact, with a little digging, you can trace its beginnings to a specific year, 1958. That's when Walt Disney produced a nature documentary called White Wilderness. And in a memorable scene, hundreds of lemmings were filmed committing what was called mass suicide by senselessly throwing themselves off a cliff.
There you go. Walt Disney is very powerful. They actually live-trapped a whole bunch of lemmings and then basically forced them off a cliff and filmed it.
Dr. Donald Reed is a conservation biologist in Canada.
Just call me Don.
May I call you a lemmings expert? How do I describe you?
I studied lemmings for my PhD and have subsequently worked on them in the Arctic as well, yeah.
And he's a walking lemmings encyclopedia and the perfect guy to set us straight.
I would say calling any of their behavior suicidal is nonsense. I mean, being suicidal is an evolutionary dead end, of course. It couldn't be selected for and persist in a population. So you won't find really any organism in wild nature that intentionally commits suicide. The fact that it exists so much in human beings is, well, I suppose it's something that you're investigating and I really don't know that much about, but it's certainly not an evolutionarily driven phenomenon, even though it might be associated with certain mental diseases like depression.
Associated with depression, Dr. Reed says. Well, there's something rather surprising about that, too.
The vast majority of people that are depressed don't die by suicide. They don't even attempt suicide.
Dr. Dan Rydenberg is the executive director of SAVE, a suicide prevention organization.
Suicidal thinking is one of the symptoms of depression, of a major depressive episode. And so oftentimes the media will portray and books will portray that depression is directly connected to suicide, and it's not. There's definitely a correlation. Somewhere between 40% and 60% of the people that we lose to suicide have a depressive illness at the time of their death. But they don't go hand in hand necessarily.
Is it because young people in Colorado just snapped? Was there a terrible breakup or a fight with parents or a car accident?
We know there's no doubt that there's never just one thing that leads to a suicide. It's always multiple things that happen.
And having your friend or someone you know die when you're a teen appears to be one of those things. Just months before Riley Winters died by suicide, two kids she knew killed themselves. One was an older girl who went to her high school, and the other was a boy in her Christian youth group. They weren't friends of hers exactly, but she knew them through social media. That's something experts believe plays a huge role in these clusters of teen suicides. These kinds of deaths can't be kept secret anymore. Kids hear about them on social media almost as soon as they happen. And talk of these deaths goes way beyond a close circle of friends. Kids from all over town hear about it.
I remember being at the police department here. We had a tragic, very public suicide the night before. And coming home and making dinner and having a glass of wine. And at 6:30, my freshman daughter coming home and saying, I'm like, how was your day? Just pretending to be positive. And she goes, Mom, did you hear about the kid at TCA? And I'm like, I did. When did you hear? Early this morning.
Susan Payne is the founder of Safe to Tell Colorado, a prevention initiative that allows people to anonymously report concerns they have about their safety or the safety of others. She's also watched the suicide cluster as the mom of a Colorado Springs teen.
And while I knew the cause of death, I protected my heart in saying, I don't really want to know where he was found. And she knew all of that, along with a photo of his body. So that is the kind of thing that our children are exposed to through social media.
It has long been established that when someone close to you dies by suicide, something shifts. The taboo of killing yourself vanishes, and the social prohibition that says suicide is something you should not do, that disappears too. Social media just adds to that because more people hear about it. In the past, suicide couldn't become part of the cultural script because it was kept under wraps. No one talked about it. That's why in the past, journalists like me didn't cover them. We were hoping that by not discussing a suicide, we'd help prevent another one. Today, that seems almost quaint. All the talk begins to normalize suicide, and breaks down what psychologists say are the natural barriers to self-harm. And social media appears to amplify not just the suicide itself, but the grief as well. Is that what happened to Riley?
For another young person that's really struggling with either depression or bipolar disorder or anxiety or anything, what happens for that second young person is they start to see that they can have that same kind of grief response if they die in the same way.
We've known for decades that suicide can be contagious and transmitted between people. In Colorado Springs, the kids who killed themselves didn't all go to the same school. But they might as well have, because they were so connected by social media. Experts suspect that all that connectivity allows kids to over-identify with the people who died. It turns out there's a reason for that, and it's in the way the brain is developing between the ages of 13 and 24. Adults typically rely on the frontal lobes of the brain to respond to situations. But adolescents depend more on the part of the brain called the ventral striatum, which, without getting too technical, helps the prefrontal cortex make decisions. Robert Sapolsky, a professor of biology, neurology, and neurosurgery at Stanford University, explains.
What they think about themselves when they go home at the end of the day and they're looking in the mirror there and seeing both their literal and their psychic zits and deciding what does this mean, that's where the frontal work that it takes to reappraise and decide, well, yeah, this is a crummy outcome, but you know, this isn't actually forever or the whole world. That's where they have trouble with it.
They have trouble with it because that ventral striatum is a kind of second string decision maker. It tends to make decisions quickly. And researchers believe it doesn't assess situations very well. As a result, small things can take on tragic importance for adolescents.
Adolescents, when they have setbacks, much more prone towards not only more of a global, that's it, I'm a loser, I'm a dork, this has always been the case, this will always be the case, but they're less capable of doing this sort of reappraisal we do when other people are telling us that, saying, I know for a fact this is not who I am, here are the exceptions, here's why this person may be doing this in a way to bring me down. Adolescents, on the other hand, sort of what the world thinks of them very often is what they conclude they are.
So it's possible that adolescents think the smallest setback is the end of the world, not necessarily because they're overly dramatic, but rather it may be because that's what their developing brains are telling them. And that could also be contributing to the suicides around Colorado Springs.
So down at the lake here, you'll turn right.
Okay.
The big one with all the snow on it is Pikes Peak. It almost looks like a painting to someone who is first arriving here and first taking in the scene.
Chloe Love went to school with Riley Winters at Discovery Canyon campus.
How far is it up this road?
If you just keep going straight, you'll need to get to the left lane. And it's going to be the huge line of cars.
Chloe says most days school starts pretty much the way you'd expect.
Walking in, our principal or a security guard usually holds the door open for us and says, good morning, welcome in.
And then in the spring of 2015, the first suicide cluster started, and 5 kids died in the space of about a month.
When you get to school after that first day, and everything's quiet and respectful, and the kids don't really laugh or make jokes or have fun, really.
Chloe didn't know Riley Winters that well, but just a year earlier, her best friend, Mackenzie Crump, killed herself. She was one of the first kids in the suicide cluster that started in 2015.
She had a lot going for her.
We went to Chloe's house to talk to her and her mom, Tracy, and we sat with them on stools in their kitchen.
She was going to try out for cheerleading. She got accepted into a choir that she wanted to get into, and she was going to start getting into theater as well. Something just happened with her, and it happened, and it was incredibly shocking, and I don't really know what went wrong.
The first real sign that something was wrong came in the form of an apologetic text from Mackenzie. She wrote that she was sorry things were working out the way they were. And while no one was sure what she meant by that, someone called that hotline, Safe to Tell, and said they were worried about her. But there was some confusion about where she lived. And by the time the authorities got to Mackenzie Crump's house, it was too late.
One of my friends walked out of the principal's office in tears, and I knew when I saw her that she was gone.
Why did you immediately think that's what it was?
I don't know. Because the text, the way that my friends were talking about it, they were like, do you think she's going to do something to herself? We had a suicide on New Year's Eve that same year, and so, like, I didn't know her, but I was just kind of like, wow, someone from our school, like, committed suicide, and now they're gone.
And this, psychologists say, is what might be at the core of teen suicide contagion. When one person kills themselves, suicide becomes an option.
It was when I was in seventh grade that I first, like, found out, like, I was first introduced to this, all of this, and then again my freshman year, and again my sophomore year, and now again this year.
So if we're trying to piece together what might motivate a suicide cluster, you start with the teenage brain and its tendency to shade events in a negative way. Then you have a host of kids killing themselves in a very public way at a time in an adolescent's life when they find emotional distress particularly contagious. And what you end up with is suicide becoming a cultural and accepted script for young people trying to deal with stress. If that just sounds crazy, ask Chloe.
I was thinking about my future, and I'd be like, I don't really feel like I have a future. I don't really think I'm going anywhere, and so why should I stay? My freshman year, when I auditioned for Flat Stanley, I'm sorry if this makes you cry, Mom. Before I auditioned, I was like, if I don't get into this, I'm done.
As Dr. Sapolsky suggested earlier, she wasn't accepting the rejection as just part of the process. Chloe thought it was saying something about her, specifically. And that was soul-crushing. Then on top of all that, Mackenzie died.
It didn't get really bad until after Mackenzie happened. And, like, that's when I realized it. And I just thought about it, how good Mackenzie's life was before she did it and how it affected everyone. And I just thought, like, this isn't what I want to happen. So that's why I got help, because I realized that it was getting bad, and if I let it continue, that something might switch.
But she was lucky. She had someone to reach out to. She called her boyfriend, and he immediately suggested she talk to a counselor at school. Research tells us support systems are the best way to derail a suicide. The problem is, if you live in Colorado Springs, the subject of suicide keeps coming up.
We specifically came here for our kids because it was a good town.
Chloe's mom, Tracy Love.
I cannot wait until she's done with school. Let's put it that way. I don't worry when she goes to school because I think we have an open dialogue now and we're talking and I'm constantly asking her how things are going. But I have considered, you know, homeschooling, which I never would have done before, ever. You know, it's just unfortunate things that have happened that you do worry as a parent. Yeah, I do.
There was one morning shortly before Riley died when she stood in the doorway of her mother's bathroom and just burst into tears.
You know, in her underwear and a t-shirt. And she was like, Mom, I can't go to school. And I said, Riley, you're not even dressed. And I said, what's wrong? You know, are you sick? And she was like, I don't want to go to school. I'm so tired. And she started, like, bawling almost. And that wasn't like Riley. And I'm like, Riley, what is the matter? And then she just stood there and she started crying. I can't. I'm so tired. I just want to sleep. And I immediately said, I'll call the school and you can just stay here.
There was a good reason she was so tired. After she died, her parents went through her cell phone messages, and they discovered that she'd been sneaking out the entire week before she died. She was out until 3 or 4 in the morning, partying with friends, but was still showing up to school on time. Being tired hardly seems like enough to have inspired Riley to do what she did, but it turns out it could have had a bigger effect than any of us would have thought. The Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration lists sleep disturbances as one of the top 10 warning signs of suicide.
One of the purposes of sleep is to enable us to function, and sleep is really a barometer of our well-being in many ways. We know that sleep disturbances change and influence the way that we think the next day, process emotions, the way that we feel, and so forth.
Rebecca Bernard is a suicidologist at Stanford University. Studies show that adolescents who get less than 6 hours of sleep each night are more likely to report symptoms of depression than are teens who get more sleep.
It's not rocket science. How we sleep affects how we feel the next day, and that includes also how we think about things in general. And we know that really central to depression itself are these inaccurate thoughts that we have. I mean, when we feel depressed, we do not think accurately.
The American Academy of Pediatrics recommended in 2014 that high schools start no earlier than 8:30 in the morning because studies show that adolescent mental health problems can be linked to lack of sleep. The bell at Riley's high school rang at 7:45.
This was the last picture that she posted on Instagram.
Do you see anything in that picture? It seems normal to me.
Yeah. I mean, I can look for stuff, you know? Yeah. Now, you know, I mean, does she look happy? Does she look sad? You know, is she drunk? Is she, you know what I mean?
Right.
To me, it's a sad picture because I know it's the last picture.
When anyone dies suddenly, you can't help but go back to your last interaction with them and look for glimmers of an explanation. Lucretia got text messages from Riley that last night.
I told her I loved her, you know, a million Reese's Pieces, and when she said, you're a great mom, and I said, well, I think you're a pretty, you know, great kid yourself, and I love you very much, and I'm like, where are you? And she didn't respond. And so I tried calling her. She didn't respond.
Lucretia and Joel were worried and drove out to Riley's dad's house. A bunch of Riley's friends were already there, tromping through the dark woods, looking for her.
The moment that I realized that something was wrong was when her dad took the phone away from, I was talking to her brother. He took the phone away from me and asked our son, do you have my gun? And I said, what gun?
The prevalence of guns in a state like Colorado could be adding to the number of suicides. Harvard School of Public Health found a powerful link between gun ownership and suicide in a study of all 50 states. It found that in states where guns were prevalent, rates of suicide were higher. They also found that the inverse was true. In states where gun ownership is less common, suicide rates were also lower. There are guns in about a third of the households in Colorado. Stanford University suicidologist Rebecca Bernard says the problem with guns is that they don't leave much room for a change of heart.
If an individual selects a firearm to attempt suicide, they have over a 90% probability of dying. So the method of suicide attempt is critical to some of the rates surrounding suicide and the suicidal behavior itself.
That night, when everybody was looking for Riley, Lucretia remembers staring out into the woods as people emerged from the trees.
And they said, we search back there and it's so dark. And I remember standing there and I looked between his house and the neighbor's house and I just thought, it is so dark back there. And at that exact moment, I knew my daughter was dead.
The police found Riley's body behind the house the next morning. She had killed herself in that darkest part of the woods.
We found out that she had made a comment the weekend before to a friend about, have you ever thought about killing yourself? And her friend said, no, and neither have you, right, Riley? And she was like, no, no, you know, no kid. She called everybody kid. I wouldn't do that. But if I were to do it, then she said how she would do it. And that's exactly how she did it.
That's one of the things that experts say to look for. If someone tells you they have a plan for suicide, that's a sign. That's something to report, even if they assure you that they would never actually do it. But of course, these are the kinds of clues that emerge later. Things that seem small before the death become important in hindsight.
I don't know what happened.
You know, we always want to know why, but no why is good enough anyway. Even if you do find out why, it's not a good enough reason. But it's hard to stop asking. I still wake up at night, and that keeps me awake sometimes.
I have two twin sisters, and they haven't been exposed to any social media or anything. Nothing. And so far, they haven't seemed to be affected by any of that at all.
I am parenting them totally different to how I parented her.
That's Chloe and Tracy Love again. There's no question that social media has allowed kids to widen zones of unpleasantness. Facebook, Google, Twitter, and others have been trying to blunt the impact of all of this, whether it's mean gossip at school or being the first to tell everyone in your network that someone has died. One UK group called Talk Life is trying to turn that on its head. It's using social media to intervene in suicidal situations. Talk Life began as a place for people to talk about their anxieties, and it became an app that has some 300,000 users around the world. The idea behind Talk Life is pretty simple. Design an app that allows people to find someone to lean on early, before they get so upset they contemplate suicide. Post how you feel, and someone will respond. And that simplicity is the beauty of it. Brad Duncan is a moderator for Talk Life in the UK.
For me, it's just an app. It's what my generation use. We use apps for everything, and being able to just express and share and how I feel. As soon as I post, I get a sense of relief and just kind of, like, thank goodness, I just feel a lot better now putting that out there. And then people reply positivity as well. It's a relief of posting and expressing how you feel.
Think about it as a peer support network with people who are everything from a bit blue to profoundly depressed, talking to people who can relate to what they're going through.
Platforms like Facebook is kind of share whatever you want, share however you're feeling. But it doesn't have the framework of peer support. But you have a framework like TalkLife where it's they kind of have an admin constantly online to make sure that if something needs to be removed or if something's unsafe, they can approach it in the right way. And you have members of the team, like you have Talk Life buddies, which are trained in giving peer support and active listening.
Texts and social media have added to the tearing down of a lot of kids. And now a text-based solution, not a traditional suicide hotline, is building them back up. Talk Life is turning social media into a place where kids feel safe sharing their innermost anxieties because they're anonymous.
I went through a load of stuff, dark stuff, and as a result of that, I came through it. But before then, I didn't have the coping mechanisms. And in school, they never talk about emotional well-being. They never talk about mental health. They talk about things like stretch before you go do a run. But they don't talk about, hey, when you go through a breakup, this is the sort of things that can make you feel better. If you're feeling down, these are the sort of people you can talk to. So I think a lot of it was just, it was my first sort of crisis and I didn't know what to do. And for me, that was the result.
Brad has just finished a degree in computer forensics and security, and now he's studying psychology.
If I could just have you start by introducing yourself, please.
I'm Hillary Blumberg.
Would you like to say what you do?
Okay. So, all right. I'm a professor at the Yale School of Medicine. I'm a professor in psychiatry, in radiology and biomedical imaging, and in the Child Study Center. And I'm also director of the Mood Disorders Research Program.
Researchers like Hillary are beginning to think that they might be able to identify someone's propensity to die by suicide by looking at pictures of the brain. We said earlier that mental illness is not a good predictor of suicide generally, because a lot of people with depression never even attempt suicide. But there's an exception to that, bipolar disorder. As many as 50% of bipolar patients will attempt suicide in their lifetime, so they provide a good control group for study. Hillary Blumberg compared the brain images of bipolar patients who had attempted suicide and those who had not in her lab at Yale. She was surprised to find real differences in their brain scans. Bipolar subjects who had attempted suicide appeared to have less density in their white matter.
We find that in typically developing adolescents and young adults, that white matter is increasing. Those connections are increasing. And in the adolescents and young adults with bipolar disorder, what we saw was that there did not seem to be the same level of increase in the white matter.
So in other words, the connections the brain is making during adolescence appear to be a little off in the bipolar brain. And the bipolar patients who attempted suicide had even more differences in those connections than the bipolar patients who didn't. And tellingly, it appears most of those differences are in the connections between emotion and impulse control, a key part of the adolescent brain development between the ages of 13 and 24. It's early days yet. These experimental samples are still small.
It provides us some very important leads for our future research on prediction. What we need to do in the next steps of the research is to start to look at adolescents and young adults with different psychiatric disorders or in different contexts that make suicide attempts, to try to understand which of these brain differences might be common across those adolescents.
Blumberg and others like her are now starting to follow adolescents over time to see who will go on to make suicide attempts and who won't.
If these parts of the brain are changing over time, if there may still be progression over time during adolescence, then that tells us if we can identify those changes and those processes, then we can target them to try to help prevent that progression. And that may be a way to help to prevent suicide.
Sleep studies underway at Stanford University may also hold some hope for suicide prevention.
As an acute risk factor, it does appear to be a significant warning sign for suicide that's visible to friends and family.
Rebecca Bernard is running clinical trials.
You know, therefore, if we treat it, we're very hopeful that that can not only improve overall well-being and quality of life, depressive symptoms, but also reduce risk for suicide.
And presumably, the incidence of suicide clusters will go down too. But all this research comes too late for parents whose children were part of these recent suicide clusters. In the shadow of Riley's suicide, Lucretia and Joel are leaning on their faith.
As a believer, it's not final.
And that's your hope, and that's our hope, is that we'll see her again.
Faith may be the last component that plays a role in the Colorado Springs suicide cluster. The town is home to military bases and a number of evangelical megachurches, and some experts have asked whether somehow these young people don't fully understand that their suicides will be final.
Wow, that's a tough one.
Experts who studied earlier clusters in California and Virginia said they also saw some evidence that the young people who were attempting suicide or dying by suicide didn't fully understand that after their deaths, they wouldn't be around to see the outpouring of grief. The Colorado Springs cases are slightly different. Some of the people I interviewed wondered aloud if maybe these kids who killed themselves thought they might be able to watch community reaction from above, in heaven. Lucretia and Joel, for their part, don't think that was true of Riley. They say she knew her death would be final, though they hope to see her again someday.
Because I feel that Riley knew Jesus. She was a believer. And while it is my hope that I will see her again one day, I sure as hell miss her here.
You were the best friend in the
you ever think about suicide? Or do you know someone who might be? Here are some resources to help. Colorado Crisis Services has some counselors who can talk to you and help you find no-cost help across the state. You can call anytime at 844-493-8255.